From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. JFK sure had the feel of vigor. He was the president who played touch football and sailed to victories. He had style, looks, charisma, and always looked so cool and collected, even in a crisis. When President Kennedy was assassinated on this day, 39 years ago, he left behind a lasting image of grace and ease, the cool king of Camelot. Now, a dramatic new picture is emerging. Earlier this year, while researching a new book on Kennedy, presidential historian Robert Dallek gained unprecedented access to JFK's medical files and uncovered shocking secrets about the president's illness and medication. Behind the picture of vigor, there was a mask of pain and a steely determination to keep it private. Dallek wrote about his findings in an article, The Medical Ordeals of JFK, which appears in the December issue of the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. The article is an excerpt from his forthcoming biography, An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917-1963. So, you've heard the news. Do these revelations about the president's health and jam-packed medicine chest change the way you see JFK and his presidency? Was President Kennedy's failure to disclose the truth of his ill health a dangerous moral failing? Or did his silence speak to courage and endurance? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is the historian and biographer of the hour. Good evening and welcome, Robert Dallek.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to Bob Dallek, and congratulations on an eye-opening article, which promises to preludes a really terrific biography, I'm sure.
Thank you, Jack.
It is the toast of the moment. Robert Dallek, you'd have to been on a deserted island this last week not to hear the news. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
What you've pulled out of the archives and been given permission to pull out, interestingly, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But give us, for those who were asleep somehow all week and missed it, give us in a nutshell what we now see as the medical profile of this president and what we see as the regimen of drugs that he used to maintain himself during his presidency.
Yes. Well, he, from childhood, he struggled with a variety of diseases. In particular, as a teenager, he had colitis, which is a very serious illness. Today, it's called irritable bowel syndrome. But he was sent to the Mayo Clinic in 1934 when he was 17 years old to try and figure out what was wrong with him. By 1937, it was bad or worse than ever. And apparently, my medical consultant friend and I figured out that they put him on steroids. Mm-hmm. And the steroids had some pernicious effects because they didn't know how to dose, and at that time it was a new drug, and it caused osteoporosis of the back, the lower back, the lumbar spine, and it was terrible. We had the x-rays and brought a view box to the Kennedy Library. My physician friend studied the x-rays. And
this is Dr. Jeffrey Kelman and yourself.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. And he had compression fractures, and it was always thought, well, PT-109, football injuries.
Mm-hmm.
But
no such thing.
Just really wasn't the case. And then also the steroids apparently contributed to the onset of Addison's disease, which was the failure of the adrenal glands. And there's probably was an inherited component to this because his sister Eunice has this disease.
And what are the consequences of Addison's disease?
Well, you can't cope with stress very easily. It regulates the adrenal glands, regulate your salt and potassium in your body.
Can't cope with stress. So hello to the White House, hello to the Cuban Missile Crisis and all the rest.
Yes, exactly. And what we found in the records was when that he was going through these crises, they increased his dosages of cortisone and salt to help him cope with the stress. And when he gave speeches and gave press conferences, he needed these additional medications as well. So the Addison's disease, the colitis, he was on massive amounts of antispasmodics. He also had prostatitis.
What is that?
Well, it's inflammation, infection of the prostate,
right.
And there's some speculation that it was the consequence of an venereal disease. and this was a chronic problem that he had.
And along with this, frequent fatigue, high fevers, vulnerability to infection,
yep.
And as you said at the outset, this kind of collapsing spinal column. I mean, this sounds like a real mess.
Well, it was, and he couldn't function without these medications. And in fact, I think his success in, as a politician and as a president was dependent upon having these medications available to him.
Take us through some of those. I was struck by how JFK's medicine chest in the 1950s and 60s sounded incredibly up to date. He was just rich enough and prominent enough to be way ahead of the curve.
Yeah. On the other hand, what a medical friend of mine pointed out is that the rich and the famous may get the worst sort of medical treatment because they're on the cutting edge of treatment. And what you had, a lot of his problems were what they call iatrogenic, the result of physician intervention and giving him these medications and not knowing how to dose precisely.
So we're talking about painkillers, anti-anxiety, agent stimulants, sleeping pills, even antipsychotic drugs at some point. Can you give us some of those? What was he on?
Well, the stelazine was the antipsychotic drug, but it was used as a mood elevator, and it was only for 2 days. But he was on sleeping medication quite regularly, and the antispasmodics were essential. We had in the notes, in the looked at the documents, there were notes about the fact that he'd wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning with terrible pain in his abdomen and agitated bowels, and it just was a mess.
But when the president, in this case President Kennedy, had to go on stage, to the podium, to the event, whatever it was, as you write, this was frequently preceded by a big syringe and a lot of pumping in of drugs to put him in condition where he could handle such events.
Yep, and he did handle these things because I tried to track closely the course of his presidency and the crises that he and the country passed through. And what's so amazing is how lucid and effective he was despite all these problems. And so there was a quality of almost heroic stoicism to the man.
We want to talk at some length about that fulcrum here. But before we go there, you start your article by pointing out that there is a great tradition in the American White House of hiding illness. William Henry Harrison, Zachary Taylor, Grover Cleveland, Woodrow Wilson, Calvin Coolidge, FDR, Dwight Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. Concealment was had a long legacy, a big root here, but the JFK White House was absolutely absolutist in its denial and in its secrecy.
Yeah, what they understood was that if the public knew the extent and depth of these problems that Kennedy suffered from, he probably never could have made it to the presidency. And what's striking to me is that during the 1960 campaign, there was a break-in of Dr. Eugene Cohen's office in New York. He was the endocrinologist treating Kennedy at the time, and an attempted break-in of Janet Travell, who was helping Kennedy with his back problems. And it has the aura, the smell, the feel of Watergate and of the break-in of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. And indeed, this past week, William Safire revealed something in a column that I didn't know, that the Lyndon Johnson defeated Lyndon Johnson in the nomination campaign told the Nixon folks that Kennedy was quite sick. And they then, I believe, tried to break into these offices to get the files
on Kennedy goods.
So that they could, get the goods. And
that is fascinating. And maybe a precursor to the Watergate break-in itself.
Yeah, that's what it looks like, smells like to me.
Incredible. You yourself come to the conclusion in your article that if all this had been known, he probably never would have had a shot at the presidency. But it's this question of what we should take away from this new insight, this new information that has stirred so much conversation this week, and it's still on our minds. You write that on the one hand, the secrecy around these imperiling illnesses and the drugs that came with them could be taken as, quote, another stain on his, JFK's, oft-criticized character. Mm-hmm. But you also say the records reveal the quiet stoicism of a man struggling to endure extraordinary pain and distress. Where do you come down here, Robert Dalek? Was the JFK presidency then a kind of example, another profile in courage, or was this pulling the wool over the country's eyes and putting the country in irresponsible danger, risk?
Well, I think it was both. And I think we would never want to do this again, have this again. I don't think we are likely to do it again because the media, the press, is so aggressive about ferreting out this kind of information nowadays about any candidate, potential candidate for the White House. But I think what we also need to take away from this is an understanding that the public needs to be more sophisticated about these matters. Because, after all, if we had a strict rule whereby we said anyone with any kind of emotional or physical problem, health problem, should be excluded from running for high office, we would have lost Abraham Lincoln, who suffered depressions, Winston Churchill, who complains in his memoirs about the black dogs that plagued him, meaning depression, as well. And I think the public has to understand that there can be physical and even emotional limitations to an effective president. And Franklin Roosevelt, after all, largely also tried to hide his paralysis, and was very successful at it because there are no photographs of Franklin Roosevelt as president in a wheelchair or on crutches, and that's the way the man lived. So there was a kind of substantial cover-up there as well.
Jack Beatty, what an incredible example of the weakness of the flesh and maybe of character side-by-side with incredible strength of character that let this president overcome all these afflictions.
Yes, and from Bob's article, just the daily mead of pain both ways, from the diseases and then from the quote-unquote cures or treatments.
Yeah.
Dick Reeves told an anecdote the other day that when Kennedy was in the South Pacific, he was giving himself a deep injection in the thigh, I guess, of cortisone, and a fellow with him said, gee, that you're doing that as if it doesn't even bother you at all. And Kennedy took the needle out and stabbed it deep into the guy's leg, and he howled. And Kennedy said, yeah, and I feel just that way, too. Just experiencing that pain. But that leads me to a hypothesis I want to put to Bob. Bob, you know, some suffering can harden the heart. It can open it. It can make people more compassionate. It can have the other effect. And I'm wondering if his lifetime of suffering didn't harden this man, didn't make him diminish his compassion. And when you look at his presidency, you know, right from the inaugural address, where the only words he said about America were the domestic condition were at home, to his presidency, where, you know, he temporized on civil rights with the black revolution going on all around him. He appointed four segregationist judges to the federal bench, including one who'd compared in his courtroom blacks to chimpanzees. He backed up on these commitments. He finally acted when he had to. Was there a lack there of compassion? Could he not put himself in the place of the blacks?
Robert Dalek, this takes us further into your biography, but it's a great question.
Sure.
How about it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely a great question. And I address all these things in the biography. Jack, I think you're absolutely right. The man was hardened by these experiences and hardened by the death of his older brother and the death of his sister Kathleen and by these illnesses he struggled with all his life. But there wasn't the kind of understanding and compassion for African Americans. They were in another world from him. I'm rather critical of him in the biography on this count. He did have an extraordinary grasp of what the dangers were to the world from a nuclear war. And he was very skeptical and doubtful about the military. And very interesting material that I found on Vietnam. In fact, Jack, I'm doing a second article for The Atlantic that will cover his views of the military and the Vietnam. But I think on domestic affairs, this was such a secondary issue for him, and he was really so much a foreign policy president. This is what his primary concern was, and I think you're quite right. It was not a great record on domestic issues.
And you're drawing this line, perhaps, Robert Dalek, between all the physical pain he had to endure and maybe a certain numbing or callousness.
Yeah, I think there was a quality of that. And he and his brother Robert, I mean, they were very, very strong-willed politicians, and there was an awful lot of manipulation. I mean, they were politicians in the full sense of the term. And, gosh, I mean, some of the things I found about how Bobby got appointed Attorney General, how they manipulated that image. And,
hold the thought, Robert Dalek. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the astonishing medical profile of JFK. Was this courage or a scandalous cover-up or both? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the astonishing medical profile of JFK, about the suffering, the drugs, and the questions they leave about the health and the president. Our guest tonight is Robert Dalek, presidential historian and biographer, coming out with a new biography of JFK, and the man who had access to the archives that got so much of this information clarified and clearly in the public record this week. You can join the conversation as well. Does this change the way you look at the JFK presidency at Camelot? Does JFK emerge looking weaker or stronger than you thought, more or less admirable? And if JFK could serve with all these medical issues, how important is a president's health? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. One of JFK's most famous presidential epigrams was the quip, "Life is unfair." It was more than a quip, in fact. We've got a clip of a recording here that puts that statement, "Life is unfair," in context, sheds light on the entire subject we're talking about tonight.
There's always an equity in life. Some men are killed in a war, and some men are wounded, and some men never leave the country, and some men are stationed in the Antarctic, and some are stationed in San Francisco. It's very hard in military or in personal life to assure complete equality. Life is unfair. Some people are sick and others are well.
Life is unfair. Some people are sick and others are well. Robert Dalek, this was top of mind for a president who had to struggle with these ailments every day.
Yep, I think that was very much his outlook, and he kind of accepted his lot as a man who was going to go through life with these medical issues, always, because what was so striking in these White House records we looked at was the almost constant attention he was under from physicians and how much energy and time had to be put into managing his medical difficulties. And I looked at the question of did it distract him from doing things? Well, maybe it gave him less energy to deal with things like civil rights. But on the issues he was focused on, like Cuba and Vietnam, he was as attentive, and nuclear weapons even more so, he was as attentive as could be.
Well, speak to those in more detail for us. There's a story of his brother, Robert Kennedy, looking at a sculpture of JFK not long after his death and noticing the kind of puffy jowls and pointing out that's the steroid effect. You know, we've all seen the photographs during the Cuban Missile Crisis and at other moments. The famous rocking chair, which was in part an antidote to back pain.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a clear record that makes it absolutely plain whether the president was lucid, in command, on top of it at every moment that he needed to be? Or were there moments where his medical condition and the drugs that addressed that condition put him really on the sidelines when he shouldn't have been?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's difficult to pin down with any certitude. Of course, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we have such a complete record from the tapes that were made of those 13 days of crisis. And when he's in the room, and he was there quite often, and speaking with what was known as the XCOM, he's incredibly on top of these issues. But one sort of gets the sense that he was so admired athletes and people who had a kind of heroic quality. And then I think he saw these crises as that sort of challenge. It was like a great athletic contest, and he had to raise his energy level and commit himself to go at this in the most aggressive possible way. He did have a shortened day in many ways. He did take a lot of time out to swim in the swimming pool and engage in other activities there, as it's been alleged.
The love nest of the president.
Pardon?
The love nest of the president.
Yes, the love nest of the president. And on the other hand, Richard Reeves, in his biography of President Kennedy, said the womanizing took no more time to arrange than a tennis match. So how distracting it was, it's hard to know.
Peggy Noonan, the White House speechwriter,
yes,
writes today. She gives an example. I wonder what you made of it. You must have seen it. But saying that when JFK was face-to-face with Khrushchev and was challenged to defend free market capitalism in the face of Khrushchev's onslaughts of the superiority of Marxism, he just stalled out. He failed. And after that meeting, she says, Khrushchev operated with a new belligerence, cutting Berlin in two with a wall and placing missiles in Cuba. Might that be fairly cited as a moment when maybe the president was too distracted, too in pain, too doped up to carry the torch?
Well, the impression I have is that in most respects he was too inexperienced in dealing with Khrushchev. And also what you see played out there was his great concern about not getting into a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, because the military around him kept preaching the idea that the Soviets were likely to roll their tanks in Central Europe and there could be a war, and they wanted the freedom to escalate it to nuclear weapons at once, because they knew they had a huge advantage over the Soviets in that regard, and they had a great advantage over us in the land forces. And Kennedy didn't want any part of that. He wanted to increase American land forces to give time to resist any Soviet advance so that we didn't get directly into a nuclear war.
So this was strategy at work, not steroids or...
Well, that's what I think, that he was trying to strike an accommodation. But he knew that, as it turned out, by the end of it, he felt that he had failed to reach any sort of agreement or reach into Khrushchev's heart.
He didn't see into the soul of that Russian leader. And what about Peggy Noonan's other point? She quotes Clark Clifford talking about how the president's father, Joe Kennedy, could call up and be absolutely withering, barking instructions and yelling at his son, even when he was a senator. She draws a line between old Joe's blind ambition and maybe the illness of his son. Do we have here, the fierce father breaking down the antibodies, even with his love?
Yeah, well, Jack knew what a difficult guy his father was. And by the time he was president, even by the time he was senator, it wasn't something that was new to him. And I think he just sort of took it in stride. And the many comments that he made about his father and his old man was a terrible isolationist in the 1940s and 50s. He wanted to pull out of Europe and let the communists, he says this, let the communists take over. When they fail, we'll come back in. And Jack saw it as just nuts. And he didn't want any part of it. And so he, I think, just held his father at arm's length. I mean, he loved him, and there was a kind of mutual ambition and interaction between them. But he also, I think, understood that his father on foreign affairs was simply off the wall, and he didn't take him seriously. So I think he was pretty inured by...
Inured to that.
Yeah.
And, Jack, you raised the question about whether this hardened the president's heart. Where do you come out seeing this whole issue of health and drugs? Is it in your mind a profile in courage, or is this a scandal?
Well, I guess I would straddle as Bob did. I think it's both. I mean, to live with these things, Arthur Schlesinger, who was near him in the White House, said he never heard him complain of anything.
Mm-hmm.
I complain when I get a sore throat.
Right.
I mean, you think I would dying. So he had an incredible amount of fortitude. On the other hand, the Kennedy administration was the first time, as a young man, but the first time I ever heard the phrase news management.
Yeah.
And especially in coverage of the Vietnam War, as Bob well knows, this president pulled all kinds of strings with news executives to shut their reporters down in Vietnam. And in general, the whole – I'm just wondering about the connection between the patterns of secrecy here. You know, Kennedy had to live a life of secrecy and pretense. And I'm wondering, Bob, how much that sort of colored the whole administration.
If covering up his health problems created a kind of dynamic that seeped way beyond that. Bob Dalek?
Well, Jack, you're absolutely right. It was such a centerpiece of what they did. You'll see when you read this book, there are so many instances of how they are manipulating the press and hiding what they're trying to do or what their real ambitions and goals are. On Vietnam, what I find most fascinating is, you're quite right, Jack, he was so at odds with the press. But it's fascinating to me because Johnson hated the press later, of course, as Kennedy's successor, and particularly was distracted by what they were doing in relation to Vietnam or saying in relation to Vietnam, because he felt they were demoralizing the country in its war effort. Now, Kennedy was antagonistic to Halberstam and the press because they were agitating over the fact that the United States was not winning this war in Southeast Asia. And he, Kennedy, was terribly apprehensive that the press was going to force this issue onto the front pages of the newspaper and compel him to escalate, and he was very reluctant to do it. I found an extraordinary letter in the files from him to a memo from him to Bob McNamara, November 5, 1962, a week after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it's about the invasion of Cuba. They're still planning an invasion if Khrushchev doesn't pull the missiles out of Cuba, and they didn't know a week after the end of the crisis whether, in fact, he was going to honor his promise to do it. And so Kennedy writes to McNamara, he says, Bob, the invasion plan is very thin. Think of the technical capacity they have. Think of the nationalist fervor we would meet if we went in there. And let's not forget what happened to the British in the Boer War, what happened to the Russians in Finland, what happened to us in North Korea. We could get bogged down. Now, he was so apprehensive about this happening to us in Vietnam, I find a consistent pattern of doubt about getting too deeply involved there. And the press is worrying him because he thinks they're going to... Now, he's manipulating like crazy. He tries to get Halberstam kicked out of Saigon as the New York Times correspondent. And, of course, Turner Catledge wouldn't hear of it. But, yes, and I, there are so many other instances that, you know, we don't have time to go into.
But managing the health news was really only a part of the picture.
That's right.
I want to invite our callers in. Was this valor here dealing with all this ill health, or was JFK playing fast and loose with the fate of the nation? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Bill's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Bill, are you there?
Excuse me?
Hello, Bill. You're on the air.
Yeah, okay, fine. I want to see how long I can control my sense of outrage here. You started off wondering if this was some sort of flaw in this man's character. Let me point out a few historical facts, and then let me give you my observation on it.
Go for it.
One, he was a man who, during World War II, in spite of his health problems, could have sat out World War II, had his father bribe people and had his father use his influence to get him into the service.
So he didn't duck the war at all.
No, he was there. Not only did he not duck the war, he also got into a combat arm. He put himself in harm's way and had his father help him put himself into harm's way.
We know the history, and there's no doubting it.
Okay, no question about it. By the way, compare that with, let's say, W. and Dan Quayle and a whole host of other chicken hawks that are currently in the Congress and past and present.
National Guard, Air Force.
Yeah, precisely. I mean... my God, this man had incredible self-discipline.
But so, Bill, he was a war hero more than that, and we know that, and he campaigned, and he went on the trail, and he did everything that it takes to become president of the United States. With all that, does it bother you then or not that the health issues were concealed, even if they might have had an impact on the nation's health?
And I'll tell you the reason why. This man showed by his actions, not everything he did was correct. I'm the first to admit that. Having said that, his mental discipline, his the way he handled the Cuban Missile Crisis, had we gone in, he was right. That would have been an absolute first-rate abortion. He showed a cool head many times. This is a man who, the more you're going into his record, I begin to realize how much I miss him. I miss him terribly. I grant you he had his flaws, but flaws and all, I find myself coming away with a new respect for this particular individual and an increasing contempt for what currently passes for our leadership. This is a man of unquestioned physical and mental character. With all his flaws, with all his womanizing, I miss this man tremendously.
Bill, we've got it loud and clear, and we thank you for your call. Robert Dalek, there's a voice that we could hear repeated many times across this country, detractors as well, for sure, but there's that voice that says, we know this man in detail and as an icon, and we like it. How much of that, in your mind, is a creation of the news management, and how much is richly, fully, justly deserved?
Well, I think, you know, it's both. And what you really have, what I find so striking, and particularly this relates to the reaction that I saw this past week to the revelations, first in New York Times and then in the Atlantic Monthly article at much greater length, the extraordinary hold that John Kennedy continues to have on the public in this country, and this gentleman is one example of it. And there are, of course, reasons for it. I mean, he was young and handsome and attractive and witty, charming, vital, powerful leader.
And he did serve in the war, and his patrol boat did go down, and he did swim to shore.
Yes, and all this is true. And also, what's so striking is there's a fierce debunking campaign against him about his womanizing, about lying, about manipulation. And, of course, this side of it is true as well. But it doesn't seem to break his hold on the public. And it may speak volumes about what your caller was suggesting, that we so lack for a kind of heroic leadership for years now that someone like Kennedy takes on a larger-than-life quality, greater even than it was maybe 39 years ago when he died.
Speak to exactly how that image was created. I mean, the facts are there, but we know how politics works, and an image is presented, a mural is painted. How was it done? How did we come away thinking Camelot? And how much of that was the Kennedy inner circle creating it? How much of it was somehow the alchemy of the press just latching on and loving it?
Well, I think it's elements of all those things. The man is assassinated. He was so young, 46 years old. But what I talk about in my forthcoming book is the fact that William McKinley was assassinated in 1901, September 1901, 40 years after he died. Nobody remembered William McKinley. Certainly there was nothing to compare to the kind of worshipful feelings that people have toward Kennedy. Now, of course, part of it is television and is the media and is the fact that Kennedy's image remains so alive, and he's frozen in our memory at the age of 46. Nobody could imagine that now, or few can imagine now, that he'd be 85 years old and probably very frail, or he probably would have even lived that long given all the health problems he had.
He might have had marital problems later.
Well, who knows? That's right. So, in a sense, it's a little like Alexander the Great. You die at the at a particular moment in time, and it enshrines you in history. And you ask the public, who were the great presidents in American history? And the Kennedy, having served there 1,000 days, comes out as one of the 3-4 great presidents of American history. There's something over the top of it.
And, Jack, we hear the longing for that stature.
Yes, and, you know, and our sense, I mean, mystical as it may be, that the country went to hell after he died. You know, that it was like a Shakespearean play where when the king dies, the kingdom breaks up.
Well, when you think of it, Jack, if he hadn't died, we wouldn't have had Lyndon Johnson as president. We wouldn't have had Richard Nixon. We wouldn't have had Watergate. You know, all those things, gosh, would have changed the history of this country.
And yet there's still
had Vietnam.
Well, the hook was in there. And you show us the sausage making, Robert Dalek. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the astonishing medical profile of JFK. Is it a scandal that it took 40 years for the full JFK story to be told? And was the Camelot theme itself part of a cover-up? Looking back, do you sympathize with JFK, or does he look dishonest? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the astonishing medical profile of John F. Kennedy, about the suffering, the drugs, and the questions they leave about health and the president. Our guest is Robert Dalek. He's out with a lot of new revelations in the December issue of the Atlantic Monthly with his article, The Medical Ordeals of JFK. And he's author of a forthcoming biography, An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963. You can join us as well. Does any of it change your mind about JFK and Camelot? If all this had been known, would he ever have been president? Would you have voted for Nixon? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Scott's calling from Dodgeville, Wisconsin. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Good to have you.
I'd like to raise the issue of the role adversity plays in any of our lives, whether they be whether we be leaders or whether we be just our average Joe. How do we develop without adversity. It's nice to have a fertile soil in which to grow, to develop. But how do we develop without adversity? How do we attain the skills needed to have vision and have leadership skills? And I can take the answer offline, but I think for me, the people that I respect the most have been through something. They've been through a lot.
We can all relate to that. It's a great question, Robert Dalek. You're being asked here to go right beyond even the biography of a president to the human condition, but I maybe relate it to JFK and the extent to which you see the adversity you've outlined just in this last week, creating character versus whatever it might have subtracted from this man's character.
Well, you know, it puts me in mind of Franklin Roosevelt, who was in many ways a self-indulged offspring of a wealthy family, mm-hmm. but his ordeal with polio, infantile paralysis, put the metal in him, one might say, and seemed to give him a kind of drive and commitment to take the hard road to becoming president. And he didn't want to know till the end of his life when he was so ill, and he didn't want the doctors to tell him because, as James McGregor Burns said in his book, mm-hmm. he was a soldier of freedom, and so many people had died in World War II, and he was going to make the ultimate sacrifice as well, if need be.
So in JFK's case, on balance, all of this medical agony, the ordeal you describe, the drugs that come with it, did it make him a wiser man? Did it make him a better man, a better president?
I think it probably did, but I think also Jack's point is well taken, that it also probably made him somewhat hard-hearted or callous. And so I think it cut both ways. You know, these things are never all in one direction. They really reveal two sides.
I wonder on that point, it's only 40 years ago, but does he look hard-hearted from 2002 in the year 1962, 1961? Did he look like such a thick-skinned guy?
Well, I think we simply didn't know. He was so charming, and if you watch those tapes of his press conferences, he always had a witty response to the reporters, and he had such command of the material and was so articulate. One saw this portrait of a highly effective, articulate public figure. So it was hard to penetrate at the time, and it really in part shows you the value of the passage of time in making more thoughtful assessments of major past mm-hmm. events and of political figures. Arnold Toynbee once said, the historian trying to understand the present is like a man with his nose pressed against the mirror trying to see his whole body. And now we can look at Kennedy. But for all that, he has become a kind of mythological figure. It's difficult to separate out the real man from the mythology.
From the sainted Kennedy. And Jack, I keep looking at the quote. We heard it from JFK earlier in his own words on tape, but there is always inequity in life. And he goes on to give these examples. Some men are killed in war, some are wounded, some never leave the country, some go to the Antarctic, some to San Francisco. Life is unfair, some are sick, some are well. This hardly sounds like the voice of the civil rights decade, of the era of equality and diversity and equality everywhere.
No, and then there's that other line, to those to whom much is given, or from those to whom much is given, much is expected. That terse fatalism, that lack of sentimentality. Civil rights, it was not a profile in courage. On the other hand, I can remember a debate with Nixon where the minimum wage came up. And, of course, in a famous conversation with Nixon, he said, who cares about the minimum wage when we can be dealing with international affairs? But in the debate, he said, you can't live on it. It was just that simple, you know. So I think that Scott's point, it certainly made him a rich character. For a man of 46, Bob, there was a lot of life there.
Oh, gosh. Yes, there was. And that's what I think people feel so strongly to this day, is that he was cut off at such a moment in his life when he was reaching the height of his powers. And I think there can be no question at all that he would have won a re-election. His numbers, his poll numbers, approval numbers over the 1,000 days of the White House were the highest of any post-war president until the present president.
Robert Dalek, I want to get one more quick call. Christy's calling. Hi, Christy, you're on the air. Make it quick for us if you can.
Hi. So it took 30 years for this information about Kennedy's health to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe I remember reading that some of the archives at the library are still closed to the public. I'm wondering how many other surprises we've got waiting for
us. It's a great question. And let me put it this way, Robert Dalek. Is it a scandal that it's taken so long for this to come out? Is there something fundamentally wrong with that depth of secrecy?
Well, I am a great advocate of openness. Of course, it's serving my interest to have these documents fall open as quickly as possible. That's what
for you.
That's right. We historians want. But there is a larger concern, which you just raised, namely the public's right to know and our ability to make assessments of these presidents. Ronald Reagan, how much do we know about his Alzheimer's? The first George Bush, the role in Iran-Contra. These are questions which are now part of history, but still closed to view because we can't get at the documentary record. So it often takes 40 years to access these materials.
And here we are. Robert Dalek, we're running out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us tonight. We look forward to the full bio and maybe another conversation with you when it comes out. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, and thanks to Jack.
Mm. Robert Dalek joined us from Washington tonight. He's presidential historian and professor of history at Boston University. His article, The Medical Ordeals of JFK, appears in the December issue of the Atlantic Monthly. The piece is excerpted from his forthcoming biography, An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917-1963. JFK and Alexander the Great, Bob Dalek points out, Jack, both dying in their prime, even if Kennedy's was a tortured prime health-wise.
Yes, in the last sentence of his piece, were it not for the back brace in Dallas, which held him erect, the second fatal shot to the head might not have found its mark, so his illness may be sealing his doom.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
In a moment, a musical standard turns 70. This is On Point. Today marks the 70th anniversary of one of America's most popular songs, Cole Porter's Night and Day. The song was first recorded by the Leal Reisman Orchestra, along with a then up-and-coming star by the name of Fred Astaire. Night and Day was one of the most popular songs of the 20th century, recorded countless times by a long list of big stars from Frank Sinatra to U2. To talk about the history and genius of Night and Day, we turn to Will Friedwald, author of Stardust Melodies.
I think of you day and night, night and day.
Well, the story goes, Cole Porter was working on a show that was going to be called Gay Divorce. And the big deal about this show was that it was the first time Fred Astaire would appear solo. And Cole Porter was already 40. And he was really just an emerging talent. And they wanted to have a song that would show, you know, what a great romantic song and dance man Astaire could be. One of the things that said was that Cole Porter had the idea to use minor key tonalities, which is way oversimplifying it, but Cole Porter speculated that one of the reasons that he himself had never really made it was because he was in competition with these Jewish songwriters, and in traditional Jewish music, they use minor keys very effectively. I mean, it's one of the things that's native to Jewish music, and that's also common in a lot of the great, you know, popular songs. And Cole Porter had the idea to incorporate what he called, you know, so-called Jewish music into his writing. And here was a song where he wanted to bring that out, you know, where he thought he could write a great, heartfelt, romantic song.
Night and day.
The song became such a hit that even if the show had not been great, it still would have been a hit show just because that song was so powerful. I mean, it was one of the biggest hits ever at that point, one of the biggest hits of the 1930s, and it was a song that never went away.
Like the beat, beat, beat of the tom-tom when the jungle shadows fall. Like the tick, tick, tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating you, 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 night and day.
We don't know specifically what inspired the idea of Night and Day, but one thing that's instructive is a quote by Alan J. Lerner. And Alan J. Lerner was the one who had the idea that Cole Porter was the only of one of the great songwriters who could write pure passion, whereas everybody else seemed to write about passion or allude to it or write sentiment. Cole Porter was the one who was the best at writing songs that were really emotionally direct and expressive in that way. And, you know, Night and Day is a very directly passionate song. And when, you know, he talks about Night and Day, he's talking about everything. Everything that there is in the universe is subjugated to his romantic desire. I mean, it's about as big as you can get, you know, because the only motivating force in this guy's life, you know, according to the song, is this passion he feels for this other person. And Cole Porter has no problem coming up with that idea. And in anyone else's hands, it might seem forced or it might seem silly, but Cole Porter is the absolute master of that.
Night and day, under the heart of me, there's an oh such a hungry yearning burning inside of me, and its torment won't.
Certain songs, whether deliberately or just by tradition, are sometimes geared towards certain interpretations. Although, of course, you know, the distinguishing factor, I think, of the American popular song is that it does have this kind of universal quality of My Funny Valentine is pretty much a woman's singing to a man. I mean, that's how it was written. Whereas, on the other hand, Stardust is traditionally a song that's a male's idea of sentiment. Whereas Night and Day, it's universal in that there's absolutely nothing in it that's specific to either sex. And everything about it is open to interpretation, and from the start it was done in all different kinds of ways. I mean, there are really, really slow ballad treatments of it, and there are really, really fast swinging treatments. I mean, one of the interesting things is that Sinatra did that song many, many times, and some of his versions are really fast and swinging and up-tempo, and some of his interpretations are very slow and romantic and almost classical. Song that can be interpreted in almost any kind of way. One of the best jazz versions is that by Ben Webster and Art Tatum. I mean, it's just a really hardcore swinging treatment of that particular song, Night and Day. One of the things that makes Night and Day different from other songs, first of all, it's a big, big blockbuster hit. I mean, it absolutely is the song that everybody came to see the show wanting to hear that song, wanting to see Astaire do that song. And that was one of the biggest hits of the decade. And I don't even think it was touched until Stormy Weather a few months later. But between those two songs, I mean, those are probably the biggest hits of the 1930s. And one thing that happens in popular music is that songs are popular in the 30s and 20s and 40s even, and then they kind of go away. Like all the great Gershwin songs, or the Kern songs, all these songs, they're popular for a while when the show is new, but then they're pretty much forgotten. And one of the things that happens with songs like Night and Day is that they never go away. These are songs that are so popular that they are done pretty much continually throughout the 30s and 40s. And I think one of the reasons for that is because it's such a great song for singers as well as a great song for instrumentalists. It's a song that pretty much everybody did and kept on going, particularly by the 50s. It was really codified as one of the great songs to the point where by the 70s, 80s, 90s, there have even been rock and roll interpretations. There's one by the Irish group U2 on an album that was a tribute to Cole Porter done a couple of years ago. It's really a song that it's pretty much here to stay. Only you and
under the sun. Will Friedwald is the author of Stardust Memories. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287. This is WBUR.